Hi, I'm Steve Macklin, and tonight we're talking with Freya Norden about a whole bunch of juicy topics. And we're going to start talking about what is love? What is romanticism? That's our topic for tonight, romanticism and why it's harmful to love, relationships, sex, and happiness. So welcome, Freya. Let's
Hi.
Get chatting.
Hi, Steve. Yeah, this is great. We've been having wonderful, wonderful phone conversations about these subjects, about love, romanticism, sexuality, and I thought it would be great to record them and eventually to start inviting people in as well. So tonight, and a hot topic, it seemed to me lately between us and around other people too, is what is romanticism?
Yeah, so let me give you a definition of what romanticism is. It's different than being romantic.
Yeah, because there seems to be a lot of sort of, oh, well, you know, I don't want to give this up. And isn't this the whole point? So what is it exactly? What are we talking about? What are you talking about when you say romanticism?
Yeah. So when I say all the discussions tonight are going to be about romanticism with a capital R. So romanticism is a movement that originated in the UK in the 1700s, so 18th century, and it was created by novelists and philosophers. It was fiction. So these fiction writers wrote novels that became extraordinarily popular in the 1700s in England. And people that have analyzed romanticism have come to an understanding of what exactly is it. So romanticism embraces a number of beliefs. And here's the interesting stuff, is even though this was written in the 1700s, many of these beliefs are embraced as reality in our Western world. So many people actually believe this is the way life is. This is how relationships should be. So let me give you some of the thoughts and the understandings of what romanticism is. There's a belief that somewhere out there is a person who's uniquely meant for you. And you might call this person a soulmate or a twin flame, but they're for you. They are meant to be with you. That's meant to be. So when you meet each other, when you somehow connect, you will both know. You'll just somehow know. You'll get that special feeling that you two are meant to be together. And your feelings are going to guide you. It's not going to be an intellectual thing. You'll just feel this feeling, that special feeling that tells you this is the one, this is the person. And romanticism tells us, trust your feelings. You don't need to think about this. It's trust your feelings. They are your ultimate guide. They are the truth. They are the thing that lets you know that this is true love. So when you feel that special feeling, you want to be together. You want to be with that person that you love. You want to have this true love living forever. So it's natural to want to be together, to form a pair bond, a lifelong relationship with this person that you're in love with. So romanticism tells us that these two people that are really in love with each other, that you will have the best sex ever with the person that you're in love with. It's going to be phenomenal. It'll be wonderful. It'll be exhilarating. It'll be uplifting. It'll be spiritual. It's all that wonderful stuff that can only happen with that person, with that true love. They will be the ones who unlock that within you. And you will know each other intuitively. You won't even have to say things. You'll just be able to feel it. You'll just know what the other is feeling. You'll complete each other's sentences. It'll just be natural and intuitive, and it'll just be friction free. And this will be forever. And they'll never hurt you, and you'll never hurt them. It'll always feel wonderful. It'll always be glorious. It'll always be absolutely adorable. That's true love. So although that sounds like, oh, that's kind of crazy. It sounds like stuff out of a novel. Yes, it is out of a novel, but many people embrace these beliefs without even knowing it. Many people believe in the concept of true love, the concept of a soulmate, the concept of all my needs are going to be fulfilled through you. You'll just know what I want. You'll know what I mean. You'll just be able to feel that. And people say, well, if you loved me, you wouldn't say that. Well, how would they know? Well, of course they should know, because we're in love. We're a couple. Of course they should know. Everybody should know. Those are romantic beliefs in a nutshell.
So when you start bringing out the shoulds, and when you're inherently disappointed in behavior from your partner because they should know better.
Yeah, that's one element of it. So romanticism is harmful to us as humans because, first of all, it gives us a very skewed perspective of what love is. You're probably familiar with new relationship energy, NRE, I call it.
Mm-hmm.
So when a couple get together, when people get together, when they're new to each other, they get this amazing feeling. It's just incredible. You've got that hots for each other, and you just know what's going on, and you just have this desire for each other. You can't keep your hands off each other. And we interpret that as a deep knowing of each other. Well, it's actually really easy, because when you're new and you have the hots for each other, of course you're both thinking of sex. Of course you're both thinking of, let's get together, let's be with each other. That desire, that intense desire to learn each other is there. That's new relationship energy. So people often believe that's what love feels like, this intensity, this desire, this person wanting to be around me all the time, and me wanting to be around them, wanting to learn about each other, just not being able to keep our hands off each other, the desire for frequent and awesome sex. They believe that that's what love is. It's indistinguishable from that. That's what love feels like, and I want it, and I want it always. That's why I want to marry you. So of course we want to be together and preserve this and have this forever. That's one thing, is that understanding of what love is in the context of romanticism. The next one is...
Okay, wait, let me just clarify that. So those feelings in romanticism, those feelings of new relationship energy and that kind of I'm going to call it obsessive. You are actually high on chemicals, your body's chemicals.
Yeah.
So that is what people believe love is.
Many people do, yes.
In romanticism, that's what love is. Okay.
Yep. And a good question to ask when people say, I'm in love with her. I'm just so in love with her. A good question I like to ask somebody is, I say, well, if sex was always off the menu, never, ever going to happen, how does that change your feelings for this person? The same? Different? How so? So usually love is deeply interconnected with sexuality and romanticism.
Mm-hmm.
You never hear of somebody falling in love. I'm romantically in love with this girl. So what's sex like? Oh, we're never going to have sex. We're just in love with each other and sex is never going to happen. We're just not sexually attracted. Or I don't think he's even a good looking guy. I'm not interested in sex with him at all, but I'm so in love with him. Oh, we're soulmates. We're just going to be together forever. We'll get married, but we're never going to have sex because that's just not part of us. So sex and love are virtually indistinguishable in the mind of the romantic. And that's why in many relationships, when the sex becomes problematic, it feels like we're no longer in love.
Okay. Yeah. Because that's something that I hear a lot and I question it, is when somebody says, oh, you know, I love him. He's great. We have a really, really great relationship. We have a great friendship. We have fun together. I trust him. He's amazing with my children, our children. But I'm not in love with him.
Yeah.
And I'm like, what does that mean? You're not, if you love him, but you're not in love with him, what do you actually mean by that? And usually it's that they don't actively sexually desire him. In many cases, the sex is actually pretty good.
Yeah.
But because they don't have that active desire, they say, I'm not in love with him. And therefore, oh my God, maybe the relationship needs to end.
Yeah.
And I need to discard him and move on to somebody new.
Right. We have a problem because we don't feel in love anymore. Well, hang on, stop for a second. Explain to me, what does in love feel like? Well, you know, when we first got together and we just couldn't keep our hands off each other and I just couldn't get enough of her and I hung on every word she said and I just couldn't stop looking at her. Yeah, that's in love. That's what I want. So what they're describing is new relationship energy. That's what in love means to a person who deeply embraces romanticism, is that they really like new relationship energy. And there's nothing wrong with liking it. It's an awesome feeling. Your hormones are just off the scale. All sorts of great chemistry is happening in your brain and your neurons are firing off like crazy. All sorts of neuroplastic stuff is happening in your mind. It feels great. Nothing wrong with that. But if you believe that's what in love feels like, and I want that in love feeling, and if I don't get that feeling, we're no longer in love, that's a harmful state, because new relationship energy is not sustainable. It is only possible in the early stages of a relationship.
So I'd like to just sort of insert something here.
Go ahead.
Neither you or I are saying that these wonderful, great feelings of new relationship energy or what people are calling being in love are bad.
Correct.
And I think I think they feel wonderful and it's delicious and it's a lot of fun. I think what happens is when you hang everything on that feeling and on that condition, it's dehumanizing to you and to other people. And it's part of what causes a lot of the trauma, turmoil, pain, and the ripping apart of relationships and friendships and really wonderful units, because this chemical feeling is missing. And I'm going to liken it to people who are real adrenaline junkies. So when you do something that gives you a massive adrenaline high, whether you're going to do drugs and do some kind of hard drug, or you're going to go on a roller coaster, or you're going to do a really hardcore BDSM scene, or run an ultra marathon, something that puts you in this massive overload of chemicals. And to the adrenaline junkie, it feels incredible. And it's like, this is life. This is life. The thing is, and that's amazing because that's something that they want to experience in life, but it's not sustainable. And when they're going through the day to day, the rest of life, because there's a lot to life that's not that peak moment, it doesn't, you know, that super high is not sustainable, and it doesn't take away the meaning, the value, or the quality of the rest of the life. And if it does, if they feel like they're the walking dead, that's perspective.
Yeah.
And that's a problematic perspective. And I'm going to say that in relationships, needing it to be this romantic high is a problematic perspective.
Yeah. And it's just a belief. It's a way a person thinks. A person thinks this is the way a relationship should be. This thing I'm feeling right now, this should last forever because we're in love and that's why I'm marrying her. It's because she's pretty and we're in love and I want this. So that's why I'm going to marry her. That's why we'll become a pair bond. And that belief is one of the things that causes a problem. So if someone likes new relationship energy and they just understand what it is and they understand it's not sustainable and they want it, then the logical thing to do is when it fades, you find another person and reignite new relationship energy with them and experience that for as long as it lasts. And when it fades, you get rid of them because they can no longer provide that for you. You find another person and just keep on finding new people and keep on re-experiencing that new relationship energy. That's the only way to sustain that.
And usually in that pattern, it's described, you know, as they were disappointed. So the person who has to keep on chasing that became disappointed by the other and they were disappointed in it. And that's a really painful position to be in.
Yeah.
Is when you're let down by life.
So the factual truth is that if I'm the person who's experiencing that, the reality is I'm not aware that new relationship energy is not sustainable. And because I'm not aware of this, because I believe it can last forever, and because I'm no longer feeling it for you, I blame you because you no longer turn me on like you used to. Mm-hmm. So it's your fault. You're obviously the wrong person.
And you'll look for things that are reasons and make up the reasons. So the reason may be that, you know, after the kids, you gain 20 pounds.
Yeah.
So you're just not feeling, you know, you kind of let yourself go.
Yeah. I married you at 27 and now you're 40 and you no longer look like you did when you were 27. So, and you no longer turn me on like you did when you were 27. So it's obviously your fault. And those are just beliefs. They're just thoughts because a person embraces romanticism. They believe that this feeling should last forever. If it's true love, then it just lasts forever. But if you realize that's just stuff of a romance novel, it's stuff from 1700s that fiction writers wrote up because it sounds dreamy.
From people who probably weren't even really in deep relationships anyway.
Yeah.
So another part of that is it's just as easy to look at your long-term partner and feel a wonderful feeling spread through your body.
Yeah.
All it takes, actually, that's not for today. But if you make a shift in your thinking, that same critical mind that looks at them and feels disappointed and is like, oh, can do the exact opposite and look at them and have that warm feeling inside or a more excited feeling, whatever. It's really habit.
It comes from expectations, the way we think.
Yeah.
So I'm just going to briefly touch upon something called a thought system because most people just feel, they think that, well, the feelings just happen. I don't know why they just happen. It's just this amazing feeling. each one of us, each human being has a unique thought system. And a thought system is their unique web of interconnected beliefs, opinions, assumptions, expectations, and understandings. And that's unique for every single person. And that thought system determines how you're going to live your life, because every choice you make is made through your thought system. Every perception you have is made through your thought system. So all your desires, all your fears, all your decisions, all your experiences are made through the filtering, distorting lens of your thought system. So depending on what's in there, what's in your thought system, that's how your life will be. So to get back to romanticism, if I believe that real love is that amazing new relationship energy feeling, and I should expect that, and after 10 years of being married, I'm going, I don't feel it anymore. So obviously I married the wrong one. That'll be my perspective. However, if I embrace the understanding that when we first get together, yeah, we're going to have the hots for each other. That's just what happens when people get together. It's natural. All sorts of hormones will be flooding our brains. That's natural. I will have this curiosity to learn about her because I don't know anything about her. That's natural. So I'll be spending a lot of time talking with her. That's natural. All the stuff is normal. But if I realize, you know, the way the brain normally works, the way it naturally works is I eventually will get used to her. That's natural. So she will not be new to me forever. That's natural. So I should not expect to have this new relationship energy last forever. It will feel different. Eventually, the new relationship energy will fade. And that's natural.
It is natural, and it's natural on both sides. And there's two sides to that. One is being okay with it when your own feelings of passion and excitement fade, like the feelings for your partner, but also being okay with it when your partner's feelings fade for you. Yeah. And I don't mean the love doesn't fade. I'm just talking about that excitement, because it seems to me like a lot of people become incredibly insulted when they're not the most erotically exciting and compelling thing a person could possibly imagine. So I have a husband. We've been married for 10 years. Let's say we've been married for 10 years, Steve. And I walk in the room after my shower naked, and you don't really notice.
Yeah.
And I walk past you because I thought, I don't know, maybe I was enjoying my new tan because it's summertime and I'm starting to get a little brown. So I walk by and you don't really notice. And I keep walking and I go to the bedroom and I'm sitting here feeling hurt.
And my eyes are on my iPhone.
Yeah. And I'm here thinking, oh my God, I must be, you know, I'm past that age. I'm almost 40. My body is sagging. He's not attracted to me. Is he flirting with somebody else on the computer? And there's all of, like, basically I'm projecting everything terrible, every insecurity that I've ever heard on television or from my mom or from the aunts or from the girls talking. And I'm feeling like shit. And I'm an ultimate, and you know, if I'm really insecure, and a lot of people won't admit this, but this happens too, you question the entire relationship. Yeah. All because I walked by you naked and you didn't notice. And I have an expectation that because you're a man, you're just going to jump up with a hard on and be like, holy shit, babe. Oh my God. I just want to do you right now.
And romanticism tells us that you should expect that, because if we're in love, that's the way it should be.
If forever. We're in love, and because men are insatiable hornballs who are at all times wanting to bone something.
Yeah. That's the cultural narrative.
And tell me about expectations, Steve. So there's a problem with expectations.
Yeah. So on the topic of expectations is that many of us don't realize the condition we're in before we get into a relationship. Is romanticism tells us that this person, this magical person that steps into your life is going to fix everything. So if you were lonely before, bang, they show up in your life. I'm no longer lonely because I found my soulmate. All these insecurities I had, they are going to worship me. They're just going to think I'm the most wonderful thing around. So I'm not going to feel insecure anymore. All these fears I had about being abandoned, they're never going to leave me. So I will not have these fears again. That's what romanticism, that's the story it tells us. The facts are different. Is before we get into a relationship of any sort, whether it's dating or a hookup or marriage, any kind of relationship, take a look at who we are. And virtually every one of us humans is traumatized. And by traumatized, I don't mean crippled and psychotic. I mean having difficulties in our mind that typically in our subconscious mind, but these things affect us. Stuff that happened early on in our childhood that we still carry to this day that show up as insecurities, fears, need for a certain kind of thing to feel safe, a need for a certain kind of thing in order to feel secure in a relationship. That's what we carry with us day to day. And we bring that into a relationship with us. And then we project that upon another. And romanticism tells us when you fall in love, that will all be healed by another person. So when we feel lonely in a relationship, we blame the other person. We expected them to heal our loneliness. We expected them to fulfill all our sexual desires. We expected that we would be the fulfillment of all their sexual desires. And then real life smacks us on the face and says, no, doesn't work that way. So we blame the other person, or we blame ourselves. So I'm not enough. I'm obviously not good looking enough. That's why she flirted, and that's why she had an affair.
So what about though? So, okay. So here's the expectation. Here's the trouble with expectations. Now, what's a reasonable thing to expect in a relationship? Because I would argue that most people, when they get into a relationship, and I know that you're different. So I'm saying most people, and certainly every person who has ever come into the studio to see me as a client, every couple, they get into a relationship and they have expectations that if I get into this relationship, I can expect this, I can expect that, I can expect this. And often there's a expectation of a certain frequency and quality of sex.
Yeah.
Are those reasonable? And with the loneliness, actually, since we were talking about loneliness rather than being sexually fulfilled, you know, is it reasonable to expect that your partner spend enough time with you so that you're not lonely?
Okay, so on the topic of reasonable, is what I don't want people to get the impression is that I'm telling them how they should be. I don't believe that. I don't believe you should be this way or should not be this way. So I won't talk about what is reasonable, but I will talk about cause and effect. So every one of us have preferences, and some of these preferences are beneficial to us. Some of them are there because of wounds. Some are there because of indoctrination. And an example of that is I'm born and raised in Canada. I grew up in a metropolitan city. I'm a white guy. So I have many indoctrinations about what beauty in a woman looks like. A lot of it is a stereotypical stuff that I was raised that it's cultural, purely cultural. So those are preferences I have amongst many others. I like a certain look. I like certain characteristics. So if I own these and say they're preferences, I don't expect you specifically to fulfill them. But I have my preferences. So I can be honest with myself and go, I like this, I like that, I like that. But where it becomes a problem is when I look at you specifically and I tell you, or I think without even telling you, that you're on the hook for fulfilling my preferences. I have these desires, I have these preferences, and you're on the hook to satisfy them. That becomes a problem. It becomes less of a problem or not problematic if I find someone who just really fits well with my likes. So, for example, if some woman shows up in my life and she likes the same kind of tea that I like, and she likes the same kind of meals, and we like the same amount of together versus a part-time, we like similar kinds of sex, we have a whole bunch of commonality, then we will likely not be grating on each other's nerves and blaming each other for not having the stuff we want fulfilled by the other. So it is wonderful to just coincidentally have a person that ticks off a lot of boxes for you. But what romanticism tells us is when you find that perfect mate, that soulmate, is they'll do it all for you. They'll do everything. So that sets up an expectation that is unrealistic. It is unrealistic that a single person will fulfill all your desires. And that's a fact because the brain loves novelty. And no matter how wonderful you might be, you will never be able to satisfy at least one of the brain's desires. And that is, you are incapable of being forever new to me. That's just not possible. So if I expect you to always provide me with that new relationship energy, that's a setup for failure. If I expect to have that hotness that we had the first time we got together, that's a setup for failure.
The funny thing too is that whole, you know, you've changed to the other person, because I have been deeply infatuated, because I'm going to call it infatuated. I don't consider that new relationship thing in love. I can say that I'm in, because I consider love to, to be a few different things. One is I'm in a state of love. And when I'm in a state of love, my love is universal. It's not directed to only one thing and one person. Mm-hmm. And then there's the love that is because I've known somebody and I've grown to care for them and I have a fondness for them. So I love them. So, and there's a ton of different love in that genre.
Yeah.
So when I have become infatuated with somebody, it really feels like they fulfill everything. And I think it's some sort of chemical trick where my brain is so consumed with the wonderful feeling that they're giving me that it seems like they're meeting all of my needs and like, this is how I want to feel. And this is so great. And life has changed. And it's a trick. Luckily I've done it enough that I know it's a trick. And I'm like, this is just a great feeling. And I'm going to feel the shit out of it until it goes away.
Yeah. I'd like to address that specifically. And that is, it is real. It actually really happens. And there are scientific, biological reasons why it happens. There's a wonderful book called The Brain That Changes Itself by Norman Doidge.
Yeah.
It's about neuroplasticity. One of the ways that us humans have evolved is we've been designed to date, mate, procreate. We've been designed to find somebody and have kids. Nature has made us that way. And one of the ways that it makes us do that is when we find somebody that we're attracted to, naturally our brain produces and triggers off our body to say, produce these hormones. So we get hormones that have us feeling good. These various feel-good hormones are happening. They're flooding through our body. The brain is actually changed by these hormones. It has a heightened state of neuroplasticity. And scientists speculate the reason why that happens is in order to promote the ability for two people to come together as a breeding pair. So when my brain is turned on by a woman and going, oh man, I really like her. Oh, she's so pretty. I really want to be with her. The brain becomes neuroplastic, meaning it becomes more pliable. It becomes more receptive to what's going on. It makes her more acceptable in my mind. It makes me more likable to her likable to me. It is a delusional state, but it is the brain's way of adapting in order to become more compatible with the other. So it is literally changing. The brain is literally rewiring itself to become more compatible with the other person. It's not long-term, it's not sustainable, but it's designed to make you have the hots for somebody, really like somebody, really want to hang around somebody, really want to have sex with somebody, and then have that feeling last long enough to some degree to be able to make sure that the offspring survive, which is roughly age, say, 5-ish, 6, 7-ish, around there.
Just a side note on that subject.
Yeah.
Erotic hypnotists, I'm an erotic hypnotist professionally, but we know that that a high state of arousal is one of the most neuroplastic states that the brain can be in. So, and same with when a lot of oxytocin is produced. So using eroticism and arousal in order to make changes, like deep, deep lasting changes in a person, therapeutic changes too, not just kinky ones, is one of our tricks.
Yeah.
Because we know it, the brain becomes more neuroplastic and you can learn far better as well.
Yeah. So that's why when we have new relationship energy, we really feel super compatible with each other. And I would argue in that moment, you really are super compatible with each other because your brain is just firing off on wonderful hormones. That is a real state that you're in. And your brain is very neuroplastic. It's becoming very adaptable to the person you're with. That's all real stuff.
And because what you're focusing on, as far as compatibility goes, what you're focusing on really is that sexual attraction. Yeah. You're compatible in that way. If you were not attracted to them and you didn't have that going on in your brain, you would be pretty critical.
Yeah. You're compatible right here, right now.
Yes. And you'd be criticizing, oh, how is he at home? How does he pick up his socks? Oh, you wouldn't be thinking, oh, that's cute.
Different matters.
Oh, it's so adorable that his bathroom is so filthy. Oh, I'm going to clean it up for him. You'd be thinking, my God, this man's a slob. I can never live with him.
Yeah. Different matters entirely.
Yeah.
So, that stuff is very real. So neuroplasticity is real. The very intense feelings we get, they are legitimate. They are real. It's not just stuff you're imagining. It is a really serious, big phenomenon. That's what feels so wonderful. But romanticism tells us that's what in love is. So We expect that. A person who is romantic, a person who has romanticism, embraces the beliefs of romanticism, embraces those beliefs and wants that to last, and then feels something is wrong when it doesn't last. And I want to circle back to something you said earlier about, but you've changed. Those words are typically meant in a derogatory or disappointed manner. But you've changed.
Mm-hmm.
I married you at this way, and this is what it was like, but you've changed. So here's the reality. Everything in the universe, every single thing changes. Even stars die. Even galaxies deform and collapse on each other and get flung into wild space when galaxies collide and they change form. Every single thing in the universe changes, including us humans. That is the way all of reality works. So isn't it weird how we might allow ourselves to believe, but I don't want it to change. I married you at 27. I want you to be always that 27-year-old girl that I married. That's what I always want. That's what I like. I always want that. Good luck. Mm-hmm. Everything always changes. That's natural. So if we base our relationship primarily on visual attraction, our sexual desire for each other, which is the height of new relationship energy, then that won't last. And that's normal. But when that fades, what's left?
So it seems like there's, are you still there, Steve?
Yeah, I'm still here.
Okay. Sorry, it cut out in my ear, so I couldn't tell if you were here. Yeah. So it seems like there's a gap between what people are wanting to experience as far as romanticism, because it's a really yummy thing. And also, a fairly, in a lot of ways, we can go there if we want, a dishonest thing. It's a very selfish thing. Involves mostly projection and wanting to acquire the object that you're projecting everything onto versus what we're trying to do with it. Like, we try to take these romantic feelings and we try to make a completely different type of system, and the system being the marriage or the long-term relationship or the pair bond, this long-term stable structure, and they don't mesh.
Yes.
In my opinion, they don't mesh at all. They're two completely different subjects. They're both viable in their own right, because there's nothing wrong with enjoying a really great, great, you know, bunch of infatuation and amazing, incredible fling or romance. But it's a different subject than a pair bond or a marriage.
Yeah.
So we're talking today about why it's destructive. And I think, and I'd like to hear your thoughts on it, I think it's destructive because people are taking one construct and trying to stuff it into a completely different environment. And the environment being the pair bond, the long-term relationship, the stable family structure. It's just an inappropriate way to evaluate another human for that role in your life.
Yeah.
And it's also a very, very destructive and erroneous way to evaluate the other person in terms of, okay, I was really attracted to you. Our sex was great. This was awesome. And now I'm going to expect you to keep that up for the next 40 years.
For life. Till death do us part. Yes.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah. For romanticism, that's one of the stories that romanticism tells us, is that your partner will be everything to you. This one person will be everything to you. So when we expect that one person to be everything, that means every single need I want, every single want I have is you're on the hook for it. And if I don't get it, it's because you're either consciously withholding it from me, which is evil. Oh, that is just horrible that you're withholding it. Or you're just unable to provide it. Or you don't care.
I think there's a lot of... So even people who buy into the romanticism, as far as getting together, they bring in a little bit of common sense and they think, okay, well, you know, I'm going to have my own interests. So I'm going to, you know, go out once a week and do some things with the girls, and I'm going to let my hubby play some golf. I'll maybe let him go on a guy's weekend once a year or something like that, on a golf trip or something like that. Now, So that's a little bit better, mm-hmm. where they're thinking, okay, I'm getting some social needs met somewhere else. I have my own friends. He has his own friends. We do a few things apart. But there's still the trouble of expectations, and I'm going to talk about sex because that seems to be one of the biggest subjects of conflict where in this romantic pair bond, there's either the complaint, I don't feel romantically about him anymore, or she's not, you know, she doesn't desire me. She doesn't want me. She's not approaching me. She's not pursuing me. I'm tired of doing all the work. I'm tired of chasing her. Why is she not interested in sex? And there being a lot of anger and a lot of resentment on, it doesn't matter whether it's male or female or, but this sex thing is the big, big, you know, it's like the knife in the back. Like, it's this huge subject.
The stats clearly show that the number one and number two issues in long-term relationships are money and sex, not necessarily in that order. Yeah, they're the two big ones. Mm-hmm. So sex is one of the biggest reasons why people are having discord in their relationship and why they decide to split up.
Is that related to romanticism, do you think?
Yes. Well, romanticism tells you, the story tells us is when you find true love, you'll want to form a pair bond, and people do. So people form their pair bond. And then it tells you that this person will fulfill all your needs. So even though we might not realize it, let me just back up a little bit. Imagine before people decide to form a pair bond, two singles, they're dating, they're hot for each other. A magic marriage counselor fairy shows up and says, okay, you two, let's sit down. Let's talk about this. Before you guys get married, before you form your pair bond, married or not, before you form your pair bond, you realize you're both agreeing that you will be solely responsible for the other person's sexual happiness. You realize that, right? And you go, Okay, Dave, how many blowjobs do you expect a week? Okay, so you're wanting at least three, okay? Jane, are you agreeing to this? Three blowjobs a week. That's what he wants. Are you agreeing to this? Because that's part of his satisfaction. So even if they negotiated that at the beginning of the relationship, that means that's what you're going to get. Is the minimum that he wants, that's the maximum he's going to get. People don't articulate this. How many times do you want to have sex? And it's not just, I want to have sex three times a week. The deeper message is, I want her to want me. I want her to initiate. I want her to look at me like she did when we were dating, when we go out and she's looking at me lasciviously, like, let's skip dessert and let's go home and fuck like bunnies. That's what I want in my life, and I'm not getting it from my wife.
That one seems to be a much bigger problem than even frequency of sex.
Yes. And the thing that we're not thinking about is that romanticism told us a story that we'll live happily ever after. And we never looked at it in detail to say, well, what does happily ever after mean to us?
That's a huge one. What does happily ever after mean? And what is it that you need in order to be happy?
Right.
And I need my wife to give me three blowjobs a week, and then I'll be happy.
Well, back to the statement that I made earlier about everything in the universe changes, including us, including what my view of happiness is. So initially, three blowjobs a week or else having intercourse twice a week might be what makes me happy. That might be it. 5 years later, that might not be enough. What I might be craving is, the way she looked at me when we first got together? Man, I miss that. That's what I really want. Is I just don't feel the thing we had when we first got together, the way she looked at me, the way she was always pawing on me, the way she just couldn't keep her hands off me, the way that I was her universe. That's what I want, and that's what I'm not getting.
So is it problematic that, okay, let's just take that one, because, and is it problematic that she's not looking at you that way? Do you need to end it and find somebody? Because you see all these memes going around, right? Yeah. Find somebody who's going to look at you like blah, blah, blah. Yeah. Find somebody who's going to make you feel like blah, blah, blah. Is that true? Or is it a problem that you need somebody? You need somebody to make you their universe in order to feel okay.
So romanticism tells us, yes, it's a problem because true love is blah, blah, blah. That's what romanticism tells us. I want to communicate a different vision. And that is, who were we before we got into this pair bond? And usually the answer isn't, I was totally happy. I loved my life. I love who I am. I look in the mirror and I say, damn, I'm lucky to have this body. I love that guy looking back at me. I have an easy time making friends. I have lots of friendships. I feel deeply loved, deeply connected. I am just loving my life. And then Shirley came along and just added to it. That's not the story I hear. Most often it is much more human. It's stuff like, yeah, my life was okay. I really wanted somebody in my life. I felt kind of lonely when I was alone. I'd want to hang around friends. You know, maybe I drink too much on the weekends if I don't hang out with friends instead. Maybe I smoke 420 a bit too much when I'm alone. They describe a life that is less than satisfactory, less than fulfilled, less than complete, less than happy. And then they get into a relationship and they expect what romanticism tells them is that this person will make you happy. So the root of that is that we started off being unhappy people with traumas and difficulties and unfulfillments. And then we get into a relationship carrying all that stuff with us. And we wonder, why doesn't it go away? And the answer is because that's who we are at our core. It can change. We can heal that stuff. But that's who we are in our core in our relationship. So temporarily, new relationship energy is sort of like drinking a lot of alcohol and numbing the pain, where you're no longer feeling the pain, you're no longer experiencing it, you're feeling good, you're feeling no pain. And that's what new relationship energy gives us temporarily in the beginning of a relationship. It makes us feel awesome about the other person. Life is great. We just feel like we're on cloud nine. And then when that wears off, we become disillusioned and start coming back to reality and seeing, who am I? What did I bring into this relationship before Shirley showed up? And who am I now? Still the same guy I was before Shirley showed up. I felt lonely on my own before Shirley showed up. And now when Shirley goes out with her friends and has a weekend with her friends, I still feel lonely because Shirley's not here. I'm still that same guy.
Mm-hmm.
And the typical response is to blame Shirley and say, well, she's the wrong woman. Maybe I need somebody else. Or just to be unhappy with her. Or to conclude, well, this is as good as it gets, rather than doing the really hard thing. And that is going, you know, the stuff inside me, it's not helpful. It's not really helping me be happy. So if I could only tend to that, my life becomes better.
And what do you think about the line between accepting kind of maybe shitty behavior from a partner that you maybe live with them, and wanting them to change that behavior, or changing yourself? Because I think there can be a fine line there.
Yeah.
You know, if somebody, I don't know, let's just say somebody, is like a toddler in the house and they make filthy, disgusting messes all over everywhere. They never clean up. They expect you to do all the housework. They expect you to take care of everything inside and outside of the house. That makes you really unhappy because of the workload, and it's unpleasant. You can't have people over and you want them to change that. Are you supposed to just change yourself and say, well, I got to figure out how to be happy? Or can you ask them to change?
So I would say yes and no to all of it. And that is, there is no clear-cut answer of how you should be. It's all a matter of what you choose. So one of the truths is, before you decide to become a pair bond, is take your time, really get to know this person, find out what their habits are, see them when they're not at their best, really get to know them. And then decide, aside from the sex, aside from the companionship, aside from all the wonderful things you absolutely adore about this person, and you still might 5 years into getting to know them if you took that long, the totally separate matter is this the kind of person I could happily cohabitate with? And that answer might be no. So
yeah, people don't really think about the mechanics of cohabitation. They think that somehow love is going to make living together awesome.
Yeah. So that's one angle. The other angle is, okay, so now we've been married for 15 years and I'm not happy with this. I've got some problems. What do I do from here? Okay. I've become more aware now than I was 15 years ago. I can't change the past. Here's where I am right here, right now. What do I do? And the answer is, well, be truthful with yourself. There is stuff that is a problem, stuff that you really can't stand, stuff that might be a deal breaker, and other stuff that might be less of a deal breaker. And one of my favorite stories that is an example of this is by Dan Savage, the guy who's famous of Savage mm-hmm. Love. He's a columnist, a sex therapist, sex columnist, sex advisor. And he talks about his same-sex partner and how it would irk him, how his same-sex partner, whenever he would make sandwiches, he would just leave the bread bag open on the counter, and there's crumbs, and there's the knife that still has peanut butter on it, the jam jar is open, there's like jam on the counter, and he would get angry at his partner that, why doesn't he clean up after himself? And he would yell at him, coming down here and clean this up, I'm not going to clean up after you. And that would happen time and time again until one day Dan thought about this. And he said, he asked himself, is this big enough to leave my partner? And that's legitimate. It might be. It might be the deal breaker. It might be the make or break. And in that moment, he decided, no, I don't want to leave my partner, but this really bugs me. So what do you choose? You can try to force your partner to change, or you can say, this is just the price that I will choose to pay in order to have this partner in my life because I love them. I love my partner. They are adorable in so many ways. I don't like this one thing here, but the price I will choose to pay, I will happily choose to pay, is when this happens, I will clean it up and I will not feel bitter. I will not feel like it's a chore. This is just the price I'm willing to pay for the admission of having this person in my life because that's what I want. That's one way of being.
And that's a really good example of making the choice to think differently when there's something that bothers you. So I want to get to a few questions because I wrote a post in the Esther Perel forum and or the Facebook group, and I said, give us some questions that we can talk about. So some of the questions, there was a lot of questions and they were great. Some of them I need to clarify. Yeah. So I've taken a few select ones that are going to be easy to talk about today, and the rest we're going to address in different phone calls.
Sounds good.
So I'm going to take the easy ones. And I'll lead into them. But first of all, I'm going to say, what is a hopeless romantic?
Okay. So remember the context of what romanticism is. Is the romanticism is...
I got a Google definition. I'm going to do the Google definitions and you are going to extrapolate on that.
Go ahead, do it.
Okay. So a hopeless romantic is a person who holds sentimental and idealistic views on love, especially and in spite of experience, evidence, to the contrary.
Yeah. So let's take a look at romanticism. What we've said about romanticism, and let's assume a person embraces some or all of that. So that's what their view is on what a relationship should be. It is highly idealized, highly idealized.
And you know what's so funny is I'll see on dating sites, because I'm actually on Plenty of Fish, and I poke around and I'll see so often guys say, I'm a hopeless romantic, and they'll say it, they'll wear it like it's a badge of honor.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm like, do you know what that means?
Yeah. I was that guy. And if you want, I'll give you more details about when I was a hopeless romantic and proud of it and fiercely proud of it and believing that's the best way to be. Because that's the best relationship there is. It's just, if I could just find the right woman, I'd just be a happy romantic guy. Yeah. So the romanticism gives us an unrealistic expectation of what love is and what a good relationship looks like.
So it's not the same as being romantic. So being a hopeless romantic means embracing romanticism. It doesn't mean enjoying romantic activities, because I think that even the most practical and pragmatic person can enjoy romantic gestures because they feel good.
Yeah,
so it's nice. It's yummy.
Yeah. So romantic, the colloquial term of romantic, small r romantic, is stuff like going to a movie and holding your hand or caressing your thigh when you're driving someplace. Or she is doing her hair and you walk up behind her, hug her from behind and say, damn, you're still beautiful. God, I love looking at you. And meaning it.
My ex always used to carry the grocery cart, even when it wasn't heavy, because I have this funny thing with being uneven. Like, I don't like to have one shoelace tighter than the other, or to carry something on one side and not have an even thing on the other side. It's just a weird thing with me. So he knew how much I hated carrying a grocery cart, so he would always carry the bags for me. And I found that so romantic and sweet. And to me, that's a romantic gesture.
Yeah.
Does it make him a romantic or a hopeless romantic?
So small r romantic can be things like niceties of I see you. I know what you like. I know that your favorite chocolates are these. So I'm just going to pick up some without even telling you. And then I will put them in the fridge because I know that you like these chocolates in the fridge. And I'll just leave them there without saying anything. And next time you go to make your coffee, you see that these chocolates just magically appeared. And you look at me and I just smile at you and go back to what I'm doing. Just knowing that those little gestures of he cares, she cares, this person's thinking about me, they love me, they're attentive to me. Those are nice things that can still happen outside of romanticism. So that doesn't mean that when a person's doing those little romantic gestures, it doesn't mean that they're embracing romanticism. So a hopeless romantic has a view on what relationships should be like, what love should be like. And they're clinging to that view, believing that's reality, that's what I want. Even though real life has smacked them a few times, and they're going, oh, no, that's just because that woman, she was the wrong woman. That's why I'm looking for another one now. She was just the wrong girl.
So the same person asked, what are the reactions of men towards women who call themselves hopeless romantics and vice versa?
So what
do men think when women say they're hopelessly romantic?
I like to remind people that men is not all one thing and women is not all one thing. So
I know.
So if we take 1,000 men, that we can apply terms that are generically true to the group, that typically men weigh more than women. And that is true when you compare the two groups, the group of men, 1,000 men, 1,000 women. On average, the male will be weighing more than the female. That's an absolute truth. However, when you take an individual, all bets are off. Individuals vary significantly. So when some men hear that a woman is a hopeless romantic, they're going, oh my God, the woman of my dreams. That's exactly what I hoped for. Mm-hmm. Other guys are going, cringe. that's not what I want. God, she's going to want the whole flowers and chocolates thing and expect me to do this. And I'm going to always have to be trying to please her. I don't want that in my life. Same thing with the tables reversed. There are some women that really like that stuff that if you tell her, hey, how about this idea? What would you do if your husband got up the night before, got up early and made you lunch? So when you took her to the office and you open up your lunch, there's a little letter in there and a little stuffed teddy bear that's holding the letter that says, I love you. And she'd go, oh, that's so adorable. I would just love that. I would melt. Some women are like that. And that's not bad or good. It's just a way of being. And someone would go, ooh, that is just so syrupy. Yuck. I want to be taken. I want a guy who's assertive. I want a guy who knows that he's a man and who can treat me like a woman. I don't want that flowery stuff. So neither are right or wrong. It's just a matter of where do you fit on this spectrum, and does the person that you're with, do they honor that, and do they naturally fit with it? So the best combination is two hopeless romantics together. Let them explore that together for as long as it feels good.
I would say I think that the reaction is going to depend on how much work a person has done and how much they've really looked into the subject, because there's a lot of people who've done a lot of personal work, a ton of personal work, who've never delved into the subject of romantic expectations.
Yeah.
So they're not even aware of this, and it might sound good to them.
Yeah.
And yeah, basically the answer is it depends.
It depends.
From both of us. So yeah. Now, blending into that question, another question was, how do you think in today's world of instant gratification, romanticism is helping or hindering internet dating? So I don't think romanticism helps anything, but anyway, how does it help or hinder internet dating? And the woman asking this was asking from a perspective of a single woman in the dating world who is constantly frustrated by how men and women seem to do a dance around each other in the weirdest ways when it comes to internet dating. That's vague. I don't really know what it means, but
yeah,
I'm sure we can play with it.
Yeah. So I would say, instead of looking at romanticism as an external force that's affecting us, is I would say, look at it as part of my way of thinking. How is it affecting me? How are my beliefs, opinions, assumptions, expectations, and understanding affecting my perception and my choices in life? And that includes dating. So if I am a romantic, I will have certain expectations and desires of others, especially within dating, especially within finding a pair bond or finding a partner that I like or a person I like. I will have those expectations. And when those expectations aren't met, it will also fall within the judgment that is contextualized by romanticism. So somebody might say, they're not romantic enough, I'm not romantic enough. So that's one of the effects of romanticism upon dating, is that people are not their authentic self. They are a portrait of romanticism. The guy will act, if he's a person who embraces romanticism, he will act in a romantic way. He will behave the way that a romantic guy should be behaving.
And it will be nothing like his real self.
Correct.
Nothing. Nothing, because he's behaving that way in order to get a result.
Yes.
But he won't admit it. Like, it's not like he is even aware of what he's doing. He's just inspired. And that's where a lot of this stuff even comes from. He's inspired to behave like that. And she, with her beauty, has inspired him to be this best version of himself. But it's a fake version, and it's not lasting.
Yes. And it's not malicious. Most often,
no.
When people are dating, they're not contriving or conspiring to fool anybody. They're just putting on their best behavior because they want to attract the guy, wants to attract the pretty girl. The girl wants to attract the guy who just feels right for her. They're trying to do that. They're trying to attract rather than looking at themselves deeply and saying, what is it I really want? And if the answer is, I want to form a long-term relationship with a person that is inspired to be with me in a deep, loving way for a long time. That's what I'm looking for. That's what I would like to welcome in my life. They would come to a different set of conclusions on how to go about doing that. It wouldn't be a matter of, ooh, she's pretty. I want to get her. I want to figure out how to make her want me. Their mind would be in a totally different place.
So my take on this question, in how it, maybe how it's affected or how it's changed or with online dating, is that I think that everything happens much faster and the disillusionment process of romanticism happens much more quickly because you have the chance to become infatuated with, project upon, desire, and then dismiss a person within seconds.
Yeah.
So instead of people, you know, admiring the beautiful girl across town from afar for months or years or decades.
Yeah.
But before they decide that, oh, you know, now I finally have a good job, I'm going to pursue her and marry her, which is what would have been appropriate 100 years ago.
Yeah.
You would have to wait until you could actually offer her something.
Yeah.
But because she was beautiful, and maybe she was the belle of the town or whatever, you would admire her from afar.
Yeah.
And you would project upon her all of your desires for all these years, and she would be the one that you always wanted. And that's something that people approve of. It's a concept, you know, oh, I've always wanted her. How do you know? Did you even know her? No, no, but no, but I saw her.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I think that with this internet thing, people look at a picture, they decide a lot of things based on this picture.
Yeah.
And then they become disillusioned very quickly. Maybe they meet and they see, oh, the shape of this body is different than what I thought. Okay. Oh, So it's over. So it's almost like it's in a small dose versus a big, long, prolonged dose, but it's the same amount of disillusionment.
Yeah.
And, you can't approach internet dating the same way that you do real life interaction. It's a whole different ballgame. And it is weird.
So that's a good topic for another conversation.
Yeah, it is.
So let me know if you want me to cut it short now, because we could change.
Let's do a whole subject on
internet dating
and communication.
Yeah. And in that conversation, we'll also, we can also touch upon how we interact with other human beings, because internet dating is just an extension of the way we interact with other human beings. It's not just, it's not a fabricated false thing that we are only delusional within that context, but we're totally open everywhere else. No, we just bring whatever we are into that environment, into that technological thing. So if we change who we are, we will change our dating experience radically. Yeah, so let's save that as a conversation for another time.
Yes, definitely. Yeah. So there was a long prelude to this question, and I'm going to read it out loud.
By the way.
So we idealize a partner. So this is how one member has come to see romanticism, and he's come to see it as one end of a spectrum, or as he said, a continuum. So this one end is we idealize a partner and the relationship with that partner. And at the extreme, we have a stronger idea or fantasy than we have the understanding of who the partner is or what the marriage actually consists of. So basically projecting onto that person a whole bunch of things.
Yep.
At the other end of the continuum, we might find Buddha's non-attachment exercises in which we think of a person we consider to be beautiful and consider the materials and gross processes of their body as an antidote to the concept of beauty. So basically, maybe disillusionment with their, the opposite of projection, although I have to say, I know everybody shits and everybody excretes. So that doesn't take away somebody's attractiveness to me because I'm fine with bodies.
Yeah.
So most of us find a place along that line where it feels balanced, with enough romanticism for enjoyment and enough realism for clarity.
Yeah.
So here's the question. Do you see romanticism as an extreme at one end of this long continuum, or a separate box that we fall into our thinking?
Let me think about that for a second. That's an interesting one. Because romanticism, strictly speaking, is a bunch of beliefs. So it could be seen as a box.
It's a bunch of projections. It's a bunch of illusions. It has nothing to do with the other person except maybe their looks.
Yeah.
Has nothing to do with who they are.
Yeah.
Because they need to be pretty, they need to be a blank slate so that we can fantasize and project upon them. If they're too real, then that breaks quickly and we lose our romantic ideology.
Yeah. Yeah.
Or romantic illusions.
Yeah.
And.
Yeah, I agree with you.
Yeah.
I agree with you.
I don't know. That's hard to say. You know what else, too? Everything about our culture feeds us this concept of it, from commercials to fairy tales to Disney movies to blockbuster movies.
Yeah.
To stories. We're given this example in media, and like it's a construct, it's a structure that we're fed over and over and over again, which is part of the reason why we accept it without even questioning it. We're like, well, that's just what a relationship is supposed to be.
Yeah. And I call it specifically, I call it the romantic, exclusive, live together, lifelong, happily ever after pair bond model.
Well, what else is there?
That sums it up. That's it, right?
What else is there? That's what it's supposed to be. And if you can't achieve that, then you have certainly failed and you fucking suck.
Yeah. Yeah. When marriages fall apart, it's a failure. When a person is 40 and never married, we go, oh, I'm so sorry. I'm sorry you never found the guy. It's part of our culture. And it's not just North America. If you talk to people in India, Pakistan, Africa, it is actually worldwide. That thing, and it doesn't mean every single person worldwide embraces this. It means that it's a dominant part of society's fabric worldwide. It's non-trivial. Yeah. So we are taught this one model for what a relationship looks like, what it should be. And then we judge ourselves and others in our ability to conform that model. Yeah. That's another reason why romanticism is harmful to love and to relationships.
I admit, when I see on a dating site that somebody's never had a long-term relationship and they're within my age category. So I tend to look between 45 and 65, give or take, like I'm flexible, but that's kind of my age. And when I see that somebody's never been in a long-term relationship, that's a serious red flag for me. And I question it. Mm-hmm. I don't mean that they have to have been married. I just mean, have you been in a long-term relationship?
So tell me, why is that a red flag for you? I'm curious.
Because I wonder what is it about that person that is repelling connection? They obviously want to be in a relationship now. And if they can't manage to at least give it a try for a certain period of time, what's going on there?
Because one of the ways my mind works is I see multiple perspectives at the same time. So it's sort of like a blessing and a curse. So the various perspectives I see of that is a person could be saying that I believe that a long-term relationship is the thing that I want and I would really like that, but I've just never had it. So that fits in with what you've just been saying. Another could be is I've had a series of short-term relationships and they were absolutely awesome. They were totally wonderful. And we were together for a while. And when we were done, it was fine. We parted amicably. I've just never felt the need to have a long-term relationship. I have a lot of people that are really dearly close with me, but I don't have any partner-like person, never had, never really interested in that.
But so, see, that's where being curious would find a good explanation. But I am saying it does activate my, well, why not?
Yeah. Yeah, it makes me curious. Like, what is that story? What is the story behind that statement? Yeah, I agree. Yeah,
I'm going to say it's more likely than not that they're crazy.
I wouldn't think that way, but I'd definitely be curious as to tell me the story. First of all, what do you think about long-term relationships? Do you want one? tell me about that. Tell me about your desire for one, and why do you think it's never happened? If you don't want one, why not? What does long-term relationship mean to you? Those are questions I'd be asking and really curious about it. Yeah.
Being curious is the best way.
Yeah.
Rather than jumping to conclusions like there's something wrong, there's something terribly wrong with him because he's never been in a long-term relationship. Yeah. But that's something that would really incite my curiosity.
Yeah.
Just like if you're a woman and you say, I don't have children, and you're 40 or above, a lot of people would kind of freak out about that.
Yeah. They might, many people would assume that it's natural, that it's inevitable, that everybody, every woman wants children. So if you're 40 and you haven't had children, is it a medical thing? You know, have you just not found the right guy? And my answer is I'm 60. I've never had children. And that's because this is part of my inner wounds and part of my inner stuff is that at a young age, I did not like my parents. I thought, I don't want to be like them. And I speculate I've inherited a lot of stuff from them that I'm probably not even aware of. And I don't want to pass this on to my kids. I don't want to be like them to my kids. And mm-hmm. I have three siblings, older brother, younger brother, younger sister. So all of them have had kids and they've done great jobs. So all of them have broken the pattern. It was my fear that stopped me from that. But I'm 60. I've never had kids, never wanted them, still don't, and happy with my decision. So there's an example of someone who doesn't fit the mold.
Yeah. Did we answer that question, whether it was at the end of a continuum or whether it was...
Well, let's get back to that.
A separate box? I think it's both, yeah. To be honest, because it's such a big thing and it's such an ingrained, insidious concept that's programmed into the very fabric of our thinking. When something is programmed in so deeply, you're not aware of it.
Yeah.
You don't even know it exists because it's in there so deeply.
Yeah.
Most little children are not... Like, I grew up white. I never thought of myself as being white. It didn't occur to me to think that I was anything.
Yeah.
I just was. And it's the same thing with this. You grow up and you don't question it or even become aware of it until somebody else tells you, oh, here's an alternative.
Yeah.
And usually the first reaction is, oh, that's terrible.
Yeah. Like, or I'm not comfortable with it because it's not like me.
Yeah. Or that's wrong. That's wrong. It's immoral or it's something. Yeah. Not right. And yeah. When you hear about it enough, actually, you know what? I first heard about, for example, this was first questioned in me when I was going through a very promiscuous phase following my first marriage because I was such a hopeless romantic when I was young. And I married my first boyfriend when I was a teenager. And I left high school to go be with him and everything was going to be so amazing. Everything
That's the romantic
so
dream.
Perfect. And I really believed in all of that shit. And I also believed that if we would have more sex, then I would be happy.
Yeah.
Like I was fixated on it. I was obsessed with it. And I was obsessed with the idea that if I could just get more attention from him and more sex, then I would be happy and all my problems would be solved. Like I bought in so deeply and so heavily to this idea that I would be happy if he would just give me all the stuff I want. Yep. So, meaning attention, it wasn't like things like monetary things for me.
Yeah.
So, we needless to say that marriage ended eventually. And near the end of the marriage, when my needs were not met and he was also angry at me and he was resentful to me, I was like, well, how about you get a cleaning lady? Cause I was a real slob and I get a sex friend. That way I can get my needs met and you can get your needs met. And, he really didn't like that idea. He refused to discuss it with me, but I kept on bringing it up and it made logical sense to me. I was like, well, why not? So anyway, after the marriage, I went, I had a really wild several years and a buddy of mine who I was not involved with sexually in any way gave me the book, The Ethical Slut. Mm-hmm. And it blew my mind open. And I thought, wow, this makes so much sense.
That's a good topic for a call.
Yeah, it is. But that's, I don't know where we are, mm-hmm. how I got there. But, you know what? It was the romanticism being ingrained so deeply that you're not even aware that it's in you.
Yeah.
So something has to point out to you that it's there, that you have this programming and that it's part of your belief system, and that actually you're harming yourself and you're harming your relationships with these projections and erroneous beliefs and ways of thinking.
Yeah, I think something that's essential is to realize at some point in your life that this is just a way that I think. It is not reality.
Yes.
This one relationship model is just a set of beliefs that I embrace. It's just a model in my mind of what relationship is, what love looks like. It's just a set of beliefs. That's all it is. It's not who I am. It's not what I am. It's not the thing that defines me. And people can change if they want. I'm not saying they should or they must or it's to their advantage to. I'm saying if people want to change, they can change.
I think that it's a very hopeful message. And the reason I think that, because a lot of people seem to think it's kind of doom and gloom. Oh, you know, all my beliefs about relationships are so fucked up. I'm so fucked up. And I think the opposite. I think what it is really saying is that you can be happy in your life and your relationships.
Yeah.
And you can be happy even in the relationship that you're in right now, if you want to be.
Yes. People just don't dig down deep enough to understand what's really going on. And I have a true story that exemplifies this. Tony Robbins, the Tony Robbins, was doing one of his famous big talks. And a man who I know, James McNeil, famous speaker, was there. So James is telling me this true story that he saw with his own eyes as he was sharing the stage with Tony Robbins. So Tony Robbins is asking the people in his crowd, what is it you want more than anything else? And people are giving answers. And one guy says, there's a sale I want to make. And Robin stops and says, can you get up on stage? So he gets him up the stage. He says, are you telling me that more than anything, you want to make a sale? The guy goes, yeah, you asked me, I'm telling you, so don't make fun of me. And so Robin goes, okay. So what is a sale? What do you get out of the sale? And he goes, well, I get 200 grand commission. He says, oh, okay. So if you had to choose between the sale or the commission, which would you go for? And the guy goes, well, obviously the 200,000. He says, okay, so you're not really looking for the sale. What you want is the 200,000 bucks. Okay, so what does the 200,000 bucks get you? Is it that big stack of cash? And says, no, I want to get a car. Okay, so if you had the choice between having the 200 grand in your pocket or the car, what kind of car do you want, by the way? He says, Lamborghini. Okay, the Lamborghini or the 200 grand, which one would you want? He says, well, a car, of course. Got it. Okay, so what you're really looking for is the car. Okay, so what does that car get you? Babes. I says, all right, man. So what you're really not looking for is the Lamborghini. What you want is the babes. Okay, so what you want is lots of women around. He says, no, I don't want lots of women. I just want one woman. So okay. So what you really want is a woman in your life. Okay, so what does this woman get you? Says, well, I would feel loved. Okay, so what you really want is to feel loved. And the guy started tearing up on stage. Because for the first time, he finally saw it. Mm-hmm. What he really wants is just to feel loved. Not the sale, not the 200 grand, not the car, not the babes. He just wants to feel loved. And that is a common element in most of us, is that we don't realize that there's something really deep down in us. And we're not seeing this deep down thing that we want. We're just seeing the signs and the symptoms of the stuff we think we want. So this guy, more than anything, he wants to make that sale because of what it represents to him. And the same applies to a pair bond. More than anything, I want to find my soulmate. What does that get you? What does it represent to you? More than anything, I want sex. I want abundant and frequent sex. What does that mean to you? What does it get you? What does it represent? Those are the deeper answers that really give us insights into what's inside us, what's really happening. So when people say, my wife doesn't give me enough sex, okay, you know, you can always go to the washroom and masturbate alone. Well, that's not the same. But okay, so you're not talking about an orgasm or about the good feeling, which is virtually identical. There's some really great toys in the market. You're not talking about that. You're talking about something that you're getting from this very specific woman that you want. What is that? It's not the act of sex. What does that represent to you? And that deeper stuff is what tells us the deeper story. Mm-hmm. And often it's not literally the sex. It's not literally her looking at me that way. There's something deeper, such as feeling worthy, feeling loved, feeling desired, feeling like I'm human and somebody wants me. I matter to somebody. Whether I live or die matters to somebody. That deep stuff, that's what's really in most of us humans that we don't realize.
So I'm going to ask a last couple of questions, just so that we can keep the conversations to a reasonable length, and
sure.
we can do lots and lots of conversations because I'm actually having fun with this.
I'm liking it too.
So, if I ask all of the parts of this question, it's going to take way too long. So okay. we'll save this part. What's your personal love hurt experience, and how did this influence your view on love and relationships? I know that's quite a long story. So instead, I'm going to skip to the next part, which is, what is love? What is love?
Okay. Many people believe that there's different kinds of love. They believe that there's romantic love, and then there's a love between a mother and a child. There's a love between siblings. They claim there's different kinds of love, and that talk is similar to claiming there's different kinds of water. Well, yes, there's toilet water, and there's tea water, and there's coffee water. Water is H2O. And you can put other stuff into it, but water is two hydrogens, one oxygen. That's what water is. So let's talk about love. In my mind, the way I believe love is and the way that I experience love is, it is a deep appreciation and caring for another. Does not have to include sex. It's a deep appreciation and caring for another. So using that definition of love, you could say a mother loves her child. Even when her 15-year-old son is behind bars because he stole the car, she still loves her kid, deeply appreciates him, cares for him, cares for his well-being, doesn't like the fact he stole the car, doesn't like the fact that he's in jail, is really pissed off, might be disappointed, upset, but she still loves her child, is incapable of stopping loving her child. That's love.
So how do you know you love someone?
Okay, so my view, this is again my way of loving and my way of feeling love is...
I agree with you, by the way. On that definition of love, I agree with that. So,
I admit there's still deep programming within me. And it's not a criticism saying I want to get rid of it all. It's just the way we humans are. We have a lot of programming in our mind, and it affects the way we think. So sometimes I get attracted to a woman just on her looks alone. I go, oh, she's kind of interesting. Wonder what she's like. And I might discover that there's a lot I like about her. And I might find myself caring about her, going, you know, I care about her well-being. I hope she's happy. And if she ever reaches out for help from me, I would definitely help. And I kind of keep my eye on her, just not as a stalker guy, but just in case she needs some help and doesn't want to ask for it, I would volunteer. I would say, hey, do you need some help with that? Yeah, it's okay if you say no, but you know, if you do, I'd be more than happy to help you out with that. Because I care about her. I care about her well-being. So that's how I know if I'm in love with somebody. Well, I would say not in love, but that I love somebody. So that's why I say that there are many women that I love, and virtually none of which that I've had sex with. And there's many men that I love, none of whom I've had sex with. But I love them. And I feel really awesome. There's a guy, Russ. He's a high school friend of mine that I reconnected with a few years ago through a reunion. Love the guy to bits. He's just an adorable guy. We have wonderful chats with each other. Love being in his company. Love talking with him. Love reconnecting with him. Love hearing from him. Always look forward to seeing him again. Hardly ever do. We're not hangout buddies. We might connect a few times a year. But love the guy to bits. Always looking forward to seeing him. Call him up anytime. So there's an example of love.
I think that if you're questioning whether you love somebody, you can look at whether you're trying to get something from them in return for your love.
Yeah.
And if you are, it may not be love. It may be something else. Sometimes it can be appreciation, because deep appreciation and gratitude can feel very much like love. Yeah. I know that I felt, I have felt love-like feelings towards people who have helped me out a lot, and I felt a lot of gratitude towards them, and that's a great feeling. There's nothing wrong with that.
Yeah.
But if you are doing things for your partner, and you're doing them only because you're hoping to get something in return, and whether that something is sex, or whether that something is money, or whether that's something, you know what I mean, then maybe. Yeah. Do you really love them? If that thing that you're trying to get from them is off the table, would you still have feelings for them, or would they not be very interesting to you? And maybe it's not love if that's not the case.
Yeah.
So Let's just see. There's another part of that. Was the other part was, how do you know somebody loves you?
Yeah. And love is a very individualized experience. So it all depends on how each individual understands love. What does love mean to you? So if somebody embraces romanticism, they have a certain idea of what love is. So their entire understanding of love would be within the context of romanticism.
So it's a subjective thing versus a, so you can't say that love is objectively blah, blah, blah.
Yeah, I would say every individual experiences love in their own way. They understand it and they experience it in their own way. So somebody who embraces romanticism, they would feel not loved when their partner doesn't want to have sex with them. Even if the partner says, I love you, I care for you, I there isn't another person I'd rather spend my life with. I just adore you. I love spending time with you. I love being with you. I love everything about you. I just don't want to have sex with you. Well, you're not in love with me. You don't love me.
Have you read David Hawkins' Power versus Force?
No.
And the Scale of Consciousness? Because in that book, and according to those concepts, the frequency of love can actually be measured, and it has a specific measurement. I don't know. I forget whether it's 500 or something. It's, but it can be measured with instruments. So in, according to those things, love is actually an objective frequency. And when you're vibrating at the frequency of love, you're in a particular state. And that makes a lot of sense to me. And I would say the way, so that may be true.
Yeah.
However, the way that we experience love, like we're flavoring that frequency with all of our beliefs, all of our wants, all of our desires, our programs, our upbringing, we're flavoring it with ourselves. And a lot of times we're nowhere near love. Yeah. So when we're feeling something for another person, we're not vibrating in that frequency of love. We're actually, we could be down near grief or shame, yeah, or we could be feeling a lot of really negative things and be calling our attachment or our need or our longing for another person love.
Yeah.
And you're using the word love in that circumstance, but it's actually not anywhere near the objective measurable frequency of love. And that's a story for another day.
Yeah. I find in my observations of life is that in most cases, when people are talking about love, what they really mean is getting their desires and interests and expectations met by another.
Yeah.
That's what they're really meaning, is I'm getting the stuff I want out of this person. It doesn't feel great. I'm in love. Okay. That's what they mean. That's what they're experiencing. That's their way of experiencing love. And
with a side of sexual desire.
Yeah. I'm 60 and I'm not proud of what I'm about to tell you, but it shocked me that I was in my mid-50s when I first realized I've learned how to love. And it happened to me because there was a woman who I was intimate with for about 3 years, and I was perfectly happy with her. I didn't think of her as a partner, but I wasn't inspired to be playing with anybody else. So it was an organically evolved romantic relation, I would say organically evolved intimate relationship and monogamous. So it wasn't based on romanticism, but it was based on mutual appreciation, caring for each other. And I just wasn't inspired to be playing with anybody else. And that was happening for years. So at roughly age 55-ish or so, she decided that she didn't want that kind of relationship with me and decided we're not having sex anymore. And then we became distant. She felt less and less comfortable with my ways. So we became distant. And after a while, I looked at this and reviewed it, and I thought, you know, I still care about her. And by caring doesn't mean, oh, I want her back. I wish we were together. How I felt was I really wish happiness for her, whether she's with me or not. And as much as I miss the sexy stuff that we used to have and the closeness we used to have, as much as I miss that, I'm not devastated. And I still care for her, and I wish her wellness, and I wish her happiness no matter how she finds it. I wish her well-being. And should she find it okay to be in my life in whatever capacity, whether it's as friends, whether we talk on the phone or whether we see each other over the occasional dinner, whatever that might be, I welcome her into my life because I just think she's wonderful. So I was in my mid to late 50s when for the first time in my life, I went, my God, that's love. I finally got it. I finally learned how to love somebody. I still love this woman, even though we're not having sex, even though we're no longer close, even though she doesn't want to be around me, even though she doesn't feel good about me. I still love her and I feel good about it. And I don't need anything from her. I don't need her to like me or approve of me or think well of me or to say nice things. I just love her. Wow. So that happened to me late in life, learning that.
I think it's kind of funny how we behave in the most unloving ways towards the people that we claim to have love for.
Yeah.
And my, you know, that's not love at all. In my opinion, people are going to say, people say, oh, I'm being this terrible way because I love them so much, or because I did love them. And now that the relationship is on the rocks, or now that the relationship is maybe over, or it's changed, because relationships, in my opinion, are eternal. They just simply evolve into other contexts, and maybe the context is no longer having communication, but, and you behave in really, really horrible, mean, cruel ways. And that's the opposite of love.
Yeah. Well, that's an interesting topic. The reason being is that of all the ways that we could choose to behave, we don't analyze them all and then review them and go, okay, what's the best way for me to behave in this moment? Should I yell? Should I be sad? Should I be angry? We just react with some feeling, which might be anger. It might be lashing out angrily with angry words. We just react that way. And we don't think very deeply about why did that happen? And the answer is, if we dig deep enough, is that likely somewhere in our distant past, something happened in our life that resulted in a trauma. And that trauma had a very specific nature. It might have made us feel unworthy or unvalued or unheard. So when this person says something or does something that triggers this trauma within us, and we feel that feeling again, that reaction that we did at 3 years old, and we feel, I'm not being received, I'm not being heard, you're not listening to me, we react with the same emotions and the same reaction that 3-year-old child would react with, possibly anger, screaming and yelling, not even thinking about it. It's just an automatic response from deep within our subconscious. We didn't think about it. We didn't choose it.
Why do you think that this is deviating? So we don't have to spend a lot of time on this, but why do you think that when somebody, and these romantic types or really seem to be good at this, but when you're disillusioned by somebody that you felt you loved, and you're hurt because of what you believe. Okay. Why do we want to hurt them? And why do we want them to hurt too? Because that's not loving, in my opinion. So why is it that we want them to hurt?
It's a reaction from deep within us. First start off with what the expectation was and the belief. And the expectation is that you have the ability to fulfill me and make me happy. That's the belief, whether it's articulated verbally or not. The subconscious mind says, you have the ability to make me happy. And because you've done this thing and I'm feeling really badly, that's you, because you're now withholding my happiness from me.
So you can make me happy and you're not doing it, so I'm going to hurt you because you're not doing it.
And not just because you're not doing it, it's because you have the ability to do it and you're choosing to withhold it from me. It wasn't an accident. This is a choice you've made. This is in my mind, of course. This is a choice you've made to withhold my happiness from me. And I am resentful for the fact that you've made that choice. You've evaluated all the options and you've chosen to withhold my happiness, to deprive me of my happiness. You malicious, horrible person. And that's, of course, going on a very subconscious level. It's not going in that step-by-step articulate way that I've just described to you. It's a subconscious thing that's reacting as a wounded child would. Some children, when they get something happens, they might cry, they might withdraw, they might just become silent and get terrified. And some just scream and yell and just go into a horrible fit because you're not giving them what they want. They want the cocoa pebbles and you're not giving it to them. And they just have a tantrum right in that grocery store aisle. We react that way, like that wounded child.
So it really sounds to me like a lot of our struggle and a lot of our pain in relationships are because of faulty thinking and inappropriate expectations on the other person. So my invitation to you, Steve, is I would like to have another conversation where the focus is a little bit more. So now, look, we've defined what romanticism is. I want to talk about the now what.
Yeah.
What can we do to have healthier and more fulfilling relationships? And what can we do to avoid the disappointment and the hurt and the pain and heartache from having these expectations dashed when the person isn't meeting our needs and meeting our expectations.
Yeah. So the common conversation that I usually get that I hear from people is, she did not meet my expectations. She's not meeting my needs. I have a need for sex. I have these needs and she's not meeting my needs. That's the belief that people have. I have needs. You're not meeting my needs. And I like to dig into detail. So when people say needs, I ask, is it oxygen, food, water, shelter, clothing? And it's none of that stuff. It's not life or death things. What they really mean is that I have preferences and I have desires and I have expectations and you're not fulfilling them. Okay. Now we're getting into specifics. So the root of that suffering is within ourselves. And it can come from a variety of angles. One is, I expect this of you. And mind you, I've never told you this. I just expect it. And because you're my partner, you should just know. And you're not doing it. So I'm pissed off at you. That's just the way it should be. But you're not doing it. And I'm pissed off. You should know. That's one example of having expectations that aren't being fulfilled and blaming the other person for it. Another example is having expectations that just cannot be fulfilled. So romanticism, this brings us back to romanticism again, is having beliefs that are deeply grounded in romanticism is they literally are impossible. You cannot live that romantic life. You cannot live your life according to romantic ideals because they are literally not possible. So if someone expects that and can't get it, they will likely externalize it to somebody else that you're the person who's not giving me what I need. You're the person who's not stepping up to be that person that should be that person because these are the romantic ideals that you're not realizing.
Although I do want to bring this up in another phone call so that we can give it the time that it needs and the attention that it needs. And part of that is going to be asking you, and these are some of the questions I'm going to invite as well. All of us are, you know, all of us have the right to expect a certain quality of life and we want certain things out of life. Whatever mm-hmm. those things are, it doesn't matter. So these expectations being placed upon a partner, how do we get them met? What's a better way to be? What's a way to be happy without having to give up every single one of our needs, wants, and expectations?
Right. Yeah.
And to be happy with ourselves and also to be happy with our relationship and our partner.
Yeah.
And I'm really, really looking forward to going over all of that and having a nice big batch of questions to answer too.
Yes. Okay.
So they're a lot of fun.
Okay. Do you want to put that one aside for now then?
Yes. Oh, very much so. It's not a question I'm asking now. It's something I want to address in a completely different phone call.
Yeah. It's a juicy one. Yeah.
And I want to prepare. And I want to prepare for it too. And actually another phone call. I want to bring sex into this.
Yeah.
Sex, pleasure, eroticism, because that's my favorite subject.
Yeah.
As we all know.
One of mine too.
Okay. So let's wrap this up.
Great.
And thanks a lot for having this call, Steve.
My pleasure.
It's a lot of fun.
My pleasure. We'll do this again soon.
Okay, great. Good night.
Good night.